can't hear me or if I need to adjust anything. So my plan is to discuss many examples where computation has led to understanding and progress, mainly in quantum gravity, but also in lattice gauge theory. So this talk will cover work by many different people. I'll cite the appropriate people throughout the talk. I will give some emphasis to work that's been done by my students Wade Charrington and Igor Kavkin. They're PhD students who are both graduating this year. So the main topics I'll discuss, I'm still on slide one here, will be the Barrett-Crane model. I'll talk about some older work about its behavior. That'll set the background for discussing some newer results. I'll mention the positivity result that we discovered. And then I'll talk about some newer calculations about the quantum deformed version of the Barrett-Crane model. After that, I'll focus on some things that specifically involve the 10J symbol more directly. First, the older asymptotics work. Again, that's to set the background for some newer computation. And then some more recent work on the graviton propagator. And then finally, in this section on quantum gravity, I'll talk about the very recent work computing the new vertices and looking at their asymptotics and comparing that to the original 10J symbol. And then I'll switch gears a bit and talk about lattice gauge theory, how you can use spin foam methods to talk about lattice gauge theory and the work that's in progress there. Okay, let's switch to slide two. So this is a brief recap of the Riemannian-Barrett-Crane model. So the setup is that you start with a triangulation of a closed four-manifold, and I'll use some letters to denote the different simplices. So script F will be the dual faces. Those are just the triangles in the triangulation. Script E will be the dual edges, or the tetrahedra, and script V will be the dual vertices, or the four simplices of the triangulation. Now, when I, in this context, when I talk about a spin foam, that means a labeling of all of the dual faces, or the triangles, by spins. So here, by a spin, I mean a representation of SU2, and so those are labeled by non-negative half integers, 0, half, 1, so on. So if you're given a particular labeling, a particular spin foam, there's an amplitude defined for it, which is a product of contributions that come from the dual faces, the dual edges, and the dual vertices. Now, this is shown in equation 1. The most important part of the amplitude is the vertex amplitude. So that's shown in equation 2. It's called the 10J symbol. I'll just say something very briefly about that now, and I'll talk a bit more about it later. So briefly, the 10J symbol can be thought of in a couple of different ways. One way is as a contraction of 5 four-index tensors. So you put a tensor at each vertex in that diagram, and the outgoing edges represent the indices, and when they're matched up, it tells you to contract them. It can also be represented as an integral over 5 copies of SU2 of a product of kernels that I'll describe a bit later. Neither one of those points of view is useful if you want to compute it. The tensor contraction way would just involve too many sums in the contractions, and the integral is too oscillatory to get reliable data out of it. But there's a different algorithm that starts from the tensor point of view but manipulates it into a different form where it simplifies significantly, and so there's now a well-known fast algorithm for computing the 10J symbol. That's due to Greg Egan and myself. Okay, so that's the vertex amplitude of the Barrett-Crane model. There are also face and edge amplitudes, and those vary depending on the specific version of the Barrett-Crane model you're working with. And again, I'll say a bit more about that on the next slide. So let's move to slide three. So this is describing some older work due to John Baez, myself, Tom Halford, and David Tsang. So we just wanted to do the most basic computations of the Barrett-Crane model. We wanted to compute some expectation values of an observable. So we took the smallest triangulation we could think of for a closed four manifold. We started with the four sphere, and we thought of it as the boundary of the 5 simplex. So that means it has 6 four simplices. Then we used the Metropolis algorithm, a standard algorithm for computing expectation values, to compute the expectation value of the average area of a triangle. So in the displayed equation on slide 3, on the right-hand side, there's O of F, so that's the observable value for a particular spin foam F. And what you do is you sum over all the dual faces of the square root of the spin label J times J plus 1. And then you divide by the number of terms in that sum. So it's the average area. So that summation that's in green there, that's a sum over the dual faces or the triangles of the triangulation. Now on the left-hand side, there's another sum. That's a sum over all spin foams. In other words, over all labelings of that fixed triangulation by different spin labels on the triangles. And you do that sum and you take the weighted average of that observable, weighted by the amplitude that was defined on the previous slide, and you divide by their partition function. Okay. So we came up with some moves you could use to do the Metropolis algorithm to compute this. And the first thing we observed was that the answers depended very strongly on the normalization factors that you chose, these AE and AF that I haven't described in detail. So one version of those are the Perez-Rovelli model. And in that model, we found what we called spin zero dominance. So the configuration with all the spin zero had by far the biggest contribution to the answer. And then some configurations where just a few spins were a half contributed to the next order, and almost nothing else really contributed in any measurable way. Another model we looked at, we call the DFKR, the initials of the people who came up with it, De Pietri, Friedel, Krasnov, and Rovelli. And in that model, we observed extreme divergence. We had to put a cutoff in, a maximum spin, and as we increased that, it seemed to the partition function seemed to grow roughly as the 23rd power of that cutoff, so it really quickly diverged. Now, more recently, this has been understood to be due to some sort of gauge invariance that hasn't been fully taken into account, and we still don't know exactly how to take it into account in this model. Okay, so I guess the surprising result there was that the normalization factors, which sometimes are not given very much attention, turn out to matter significantly for the behavior of a model. The extremes between the two models were pretty surprising. Okay, so let's go to slide 4. So while we were doing these computations, we noticed that the amplitudes we were computing were always positive real numbers. And I hadn't really even thought about that. They just turned out to be positive, and that was convenient. But then we started to realize, well, why should they be? That seems a little surprising. So computationally, it was great, because in the Metropolis algorithm, when all the amplitudes are positive, things are simpler. And if they can be negative or have phases, then you have to do it in a more subtle way. It's called having a sine problem. And you know, sometimes the sine problem doesn't actually make things more difficult, but sometimes it makes it very difficult. So we luckily didn't have to worry about that. But conceptually, it was a bit surprising, at least to us. It meant that there was no interference between the different paths in this path integration that we were doing. This is related to the fact that you can think of the path integral as computing a projection onto physical states. I don't think that fully explains it. I still don't really think we understand exactly why we're getting positivity there. But again, this is an example of something where just because we did some computations, we noticed a pattern. And once we noticed the pattern, we were able to prove that it was correct. It wasn't just a mistake or a misunderstanding. That we could actually prove that it did always turn out to be positive. Okay, let's go to slide 5. So more recently, my student Igor Kavkin has done computations of the quantum deformed Barrett-Crane model. So here, what you do is you replace the group SU2 by the quantum group SUQ2. The main thing that this does is it changes the representation. So it changes the labels that can occur on a spin foam. In particular, if you set, so Q can in general be a complex parameter, but if you set it to be a root of unity, e to the I pi over r, where r is a positive integer, then what happens is you only get finitely many representations contributing. So effectively what happens is you eliminate all spins greater than r minus 2 over 2. So this is one motivation for introducing the quantum deformed version. All the sums that occur are finite. There's only finitely many labelings for a particular q, at least when q is a root of unity. Now as r goes to infinity, q goes to 1, you get e of 0, and that's the value that gives the classical computations that I just discussed 2 slides back. Another reason to study the quantum deformed version is that Smolin has suggested that the R parameter is inversely related to the cosmological constant. And since we expect the cosmological constant is non-zero, this is one reason to study Q-deformed models. So Igor's generalized the library of code that we had to allow us to do computations in the quantum deformed case. He also made other generalizations. So in particular, the original code was specialized to the case of the four-sphere, and he's generalized it to any triangulation, including fairly large triangulation. And he's also introduced many new observables. And by the way, Igor is on the line, so during the parts of the talk where we're discussing his work, feel free to ask questions, and he can field them. Okay, so let's look at... I have one more slide of background, slide 6, before... Actually, two more slides before the result. Okay, slide 6. So the first task was to generalize the algorithm that can compute the spin network amplitudes that are necessary for doing the computations of the Barrett-Crane model. So there's now a new library, and this library is available for others to use if you want. It can handle many different types of Q. So it can handle the classical case still, of course, Q equals 1. It can also handle Q being an exact rational number and produce exact rational answers, which is very useful for testing. It's not fast, but it's useful. It can handle Q a floating point real number. It also has a special case for Q a root of unity. Things are different there. It can handle Q being a general complex number. And it can also handle symbolic Q, and it does symbolic calculations and produces rational functions of Q as the answer. On the right-hand side of this slide, there's a colorful plot. What that is the real part of the tetrahedral network with all 6 spins, too.
Dan?
Yep.
I'm sorry, maybe it's just me being deaf, but the it's fading away. I don't know if you're talking... can you talk louder?
I'll try to aim more directly at the microphone.
Okay, in fact, now it's better. Thanks.
Okay, yeah, I guess I was just leaning a bit over this picture. Okay.
Thanks
for mentioning that. Okay, so this figure on slide 6, the colorful figure, this is the real part of the tetrahedral network with all 6 spins equal to 2. The red values are extremely small. The blue values are extremely large. In fact, there's been a double log taken here to get the values to show up differently. And the parameters are the Q parameter. So this is the complex plane, and the color indicates the real part of the TET network there. So this was computed by doing the computation symbolically, and you get a large rational function of Q, and then plotting that rational function. Okay, so with this library, we now have an effective means of computing quantum deformed spin network evaluation. It was quite tricky to do this, in fact, because of the phases and signs that are introduced in the quantum version, so a lot of care was needed. It was also designed to be very efficient. It caches intermediate results that can be used later and has very tight inner loops to make these computations work well. Because these vertex amplitudes are really the inner loop of a large computation, so they need to be done quite quickly.
Dan, so in this plot, Q equals 1 is like the horizontal axis and 0 and sort of 1 to the right. So it's in the middle of that blue zone there.
That's right.
There doesn't seem to be anything special for either Q equals 1 nor the rationals nor anything like that.
The unit circle is where a lot of the fine fractal-like detail is happening.
Okay.
So there's certain roots of unity. Like fourth root of unity is a kind of a red flower to the upper right. And if you zoom in there, and I've done this and it's really quite nice, you see these patterns all repeated, just like near the origin here. But at Q equals 1, you don't see anything particularly. There's a bit of symmetry. I forget how many now, but you see these blue valleys going out from 1. But you don't see quite the same structure as you do near the roots of unity.
Okay.
Okay, let's go to slide 7. This is where we discuss the observables that Igor computed. So the first one there in equation 3, that is simply the average spin. Now there's one twist here. So you see those half brackets around J sub F. In the Q-deformed case, you usually work with quantum integers rather than just the names of the representations themselves. And in this case, we're using quantum half integers because we're using half integers to label representation. So it's roughly the same as doubling the spin, taking the quantum integer, and then taking half of that, if you already know what quantum integers are. If you don't know what they are, just at the bottom of the slide, it says that half angle brackets j is proportional to sine 2j over r. That's in for the root of unity case, and when q is 1, half angle j is just j. Okay, so equation 3, the first one on the slide, is the average spin where you use the quantum half integer. The spin variance, we don't compute it directly or display it directly, but it's used in the fourth one, the spin-spin correlation. So I'll mention that in a moment. So that's just the variance of the spins. Then there's the average area. That's the same as was computed in the older work. There it was called O, here it's called capital A, but it's the same formula with the addition of the half brackets. And then there's the spin-spin correlation function. So this one, you specify a distance d. This is a combinatorial distance within the triangulation that doesn't take into account the labeling. It's roughly the number of steps through the triangulation you have to take to get from one triangle to another. And then we sum over all pairs of triangles, f and f prime, which are that distance apart, of the function shown in the summation there. So j sub f times j sub f prime minus the square of the mean, and then we divide by the expected value of the squared, or of the variance. There's also a normalization factor, which is roughly the number of terms in that sum, but it can be slightly different if the degree or if the number of neighbors that a face has isn't uniform. So it's something that takes into account possible non-uniformity in the triangulation. Okay, so again, we're going to compute these observables using the Metropolis algorithm. The positivity result still holds in the root of unity case. So there's still no sign problem, so we can do computations. And these are shown on slide 8. Okay, so in this slide... Yes?
Before you start the results.
Yeah.
I have a kind of a very basic confusion, and I will just raise it now, and if anybody can answer it quickly, fine. Otherwise, we will come to it at the end.
Mm-hmm.
And that confusion has to do with the use of the quantum deformed SU2. I understand doing it just in the middle of the calculation, but I don't understand what its meaning is, so to say, from scratch. Are we now considering, instead of SU2 connections, some very sophisticated connections which take values in the half algebra? Or what are we doing here in terms of, I mean, what theory are we talking about if we look at quantum groups here?
And the right. SU2,
yeah.
Yeah, and so the connection to loop quantum gravity is not so clear to me either. But to be honest, the connection of the Barrett-Crane model to loop quantum gravity is also not completely understood, even in the classical case.
Okay. There may be people in Warsaw on the phone, and they might be able to, at the end of the discussion,
actually, if I could just jump in, it's Igor from Western Ontario. So the connection to loop quantum gravity is a bit tenuous, like for most pinfold models, unfortunately. But it's briefly summarized in our paper. So starting from loop quantum gravity, Smolin has made an argument that if you take a Kodama state that includes a non-trivial cosmological constant, it's some state, and it could be expanded in a basis of spin networks. Spin networks are usually defined in loop quantum gravity. And what you get there, the transition coefficients from the Kodama state to the spin network basis, are spin network evaluations with some non-trivial deformation of SU2 to SU2Q, where Q is related to the cosmological constant. Now, given that information, so from the point of view of spin foams, is that we basically change the representations that we use in our computation. So that's as direct a connection as I can make.
Right. I mean, the main confusion is really about the first step itself as to within, I mean, this whole business about Kodama state, and
yeah.
Kodama state doesn't belong to the standard Hilbert space, and what does this expansion mean? Is there a Hilbert space at all? Are these expansions meaningful? Is there actually a measure? These are the questions that are open. But people in Warsaw have been thinking about quantum deformed sort of connections which take values in the quantum deformed groups, and they may perhaps shed some light on it at the end of the discussion.
Okay.
If I can just say, these are long-standing questions. The connection Igor just described, I think, is well understood in the Euclidean case and Lorentzian case. There are some open issues.
I don't think so.
We can discuss it.
Can
I add something? Hello?
Yeah.
Well, sorry, is that my phone feedbacking?
Yeah.
So, I mean, the thing, there's a case where it's very well understood, which is the case of 3D gravity. The thing is that you're looking at the dynamical amplitude, and then suppose you insert the cosmological constant. So now this dynamical amplitude will depend on this extra parameter, which is the cosmological constant. The boundary states are still labeled by SU2 spin networks, but what happens is that when you compute the dynamical amplitude, it happens that this scalar product, or the physical scalar product, is conveniently, you know, computed in terms of quantum groups. But it's just really the difference between the kinematical scalar product and the physical scalar product. So in 2 plus 1, you can really prove that. The boundary states are always the same, whether there is or there is not a cosmological constant. But the physical scalar product, you know, include quantum groups or do not include quantum groups. And the quantum group label is just, you know, labeling the cosmological constant. So the hope is that the same thing is true for a 4D case, but it's not shown or it's not clear. The boundary state should be the same. Once we have identified, you know, the proper boundary state, the amplitude, we expect the amplitude to be governed by quantum groups and this parameter. But you don't have really to redo the dynamics in terms of algebra or et cetera at the kinematical level. So it doesn't change the kinematics, but it changes the dynamics.
And that is one hope, I agree. That is one way to go about doing it.
But
I think
proven,
this really is a side remark, so I think we should let Dan go to the main point, and then at the end we can come back to this.
Okay. Yeah, this is a very interesting topic that I'd love to learn more about. So let's turn to slide 8. So here we're doing some computations. So the x-axis is the r parameter that determines q. Q is e to the I pi over r. So as r goes to infinity, you tend to q equals 1, which is shown off at the right. The y-axis is a fairly arbitrary scale. We're computing some expectation values of observables, and we scaled them by some factors just to put them on the same graph. There's two different models being computed here. The one labeled PR, that's the Perez-Rovelli model. It has the hollow triangles and hollow boxes. And the other one is a model that John Baez and I came up with, not based on any sound principles, but simply because it behaved in a very interesting way in computation. And that's the one with the solid triangles and boxes. The observables are the average spin and the average area. So let's look at the top row of the graph. So this is the hollow triangles in the Perez-Rovelli model, the average area. As you increase the R, these triangles seem to be tending towards a limit, which agrees with the Q equals 1 value, at least up to the error in the computation. Things seem very consistent. But if instead we look at the average spin, that's the second row, which has hollow boxes, they're tending very closely to a limit. But that limit is not equal to what you get if you set Q equals to 1. And this was very surprising to us. We really expected this to be continuous. Any particular spin network evaluation is continuous in this limit, but what changes is the terms in the summation. You have more representations to sum over as the R increases. And somehow this part of the limit does not appear to be continuous. You might wonder, why is one continuous and the other not? Well, we can understand that after the fact, you know, analyzing the amplitudes, we can look at this and see why it sometimes turns out to be continuous and sometimes not. But until we'd actually computed this, it was really a surprise to us. And then the filled-in triangles and boxes just show that the same thing happens in a different model. So this seems to be fairly generic that you get these discontinuities. What else did I want to say about this plot? Oh, I forgot to mention, this is the minimal triangulation of the four sphere again. So we just kept that the same. and focus on varying the deformation parameter. And it took about 2 or 3 months of CPU time to produce the data in this plot. Okay, the next plot is on page 9. So here, let's focus on the right-hand half of this, where it says larger triangulation. This is a triangulation with about 150 force implices. And now what we're plotting is the spin-spin correlation observable as a function of the distance, the combinatorial distance that's specified to it. And then there's three different models plotted. There's the model that John Baez and I came up with, there's the Perez-Ravelli model, and the DFKR model. The first two show somewhat similar behavior. They're the curves that dip down at 1 and 2 and cross the x-axis at 3 and then go positive. So they show some anti-correlation for small distances and then correlation for large distances. Whereas the DFK model is almost exactly opposite. It shows correlation for small distances and anti-correlation for larger distances. So well, this is a fairly preliminary calculation, but we've also done some other calculations in the paper that's cited at the top of the page. And the evidence seems to be that both the Perez-Ravelli model and the Baez-Christensen model are dominated by contributions from isolated bubbles, little bubbles of spin that are disconnected from other ones. Whereas the DFK model, it doesn't have that feature. It's much more, I don't know if I should say homogeneous, but spins appear everywhere and contribute throughout the spin foam. So this is an example of how you can do a calculation like this and see some qualitative features of what contributes to a particular model. Okay, let's move on to slide 10. So that was the end of the quantum deformed section. Now I'm going to have a couple of slides, three slides, I think, on the asymptotics of the 10J symbol. So recall, the 10J symbol is the key ingredient of the Barrett-Crane model. I mentioned there's an integral formula for it, and that's shown in equation 7. There's a sign factor I'm not showing, but then it's an integral over 5 copies of SU2 or S3. They're the same. It's convenient to think of it as S3 in this formulation. So the variables x1 through x5 are each a unit vector in R4. And then the integrand is a product of 10 kernels, so one for each pair of xi and xj. And the kernels are shown in equation 8. They're just the SU2 character functions, sine of 2j plus 1 times phi over sine phi. And so the phi you take is the angle between the vectors xk and xl, so that's the phi kl. And the spin you take is the spin labeling the edge connecting the kth vertex to the lth vertex of the 10J symbol. Now, because you're really integrating over unit vectors here, if I give you 5 unit vectors in R4, you can think of each one of those as determining a 3-dimensional hyperplane through the origin. And if you shift one of those planes away from the origin a little bit, they will surround a 4-simplex. That 4-simplex is uniquely determined up to a scale factor, depending how far you shift the one plane. So you can really think of this as being an integral over 4-simplices up to scale. Now, Barrett and Williams, in a 1998 paper, studied this integral where the spins get large homogeneously, but they're scaled by a factor. And they studied the stationary phase points as the spins get large. And they showed that the stationary phase points correspond to those 4-simplices where the triangle areas agree with the areas given by the spins up to a scale factor. So here the area that a spin contributes is 2j plus 1. It's not the square root j plus 1 that occurred earlier. There's more than one, well, there's those two proposals for the area contribution. In this case, it's the 2j plus 1 that comes up in the stationary phase approximation. So you can think of this integral, the stationary phase contribution, really comes from just looking at the 4-simplices that have the right areas up to a scale, and each of those contributes according to their Regi action. So this is a really nice result, because we hope to see the Regi action in quantum gravity, and this shows that it is there. Okay, next slide, slide 11. Once we had an algorithm for computing the 10J symbol, we could simply compute it for large spins and see how it behaves. And we didn't see what we expected. So the stationary phase contribution should go like lambda to the minus 9 halves, where lambda is the scale factor that the spins are multiplied by. And what we found is that the value of the 10J symbol went like lambda to the minus 2, which is much larger. And we also didn't see the oscillations that were expected. So this was then worked out by several groups listed at the top of the page analytically, and it was found that this is due to contributions from degenerate force implices. These are force implices that are flat. They lie in some three-dimensional subspace. So they have zero volume. Barrett and Williams had noticed these but hadn't studied their contributions to the result. So those tend to dominate and hide the Reggie action contribution. This is one example of something that's led to ideas for new proposals for the vertex amplitude, this strange behavior. I'll say more about that later. Another curious fact is that you can do the same study for the Lorentzian 10J symbol, and you find that it also has the same degenerate contributions which dominate. There's a difference of a factor of 16 just due to the geometry of the hyperbola. So what that means is for large spins, the Lorentzian 10J symbol is 1/16th of the Riemannian one. They agree just up to a constant factor. And this, again, seems extremely surprising to me that there's some sort of unification of Lorentzian and Riemannian quantum gravity for large spins. So this is just another example where, because some computations were done, a pattern was observed that could then later be explained analytically. So on the next slide, I show some plots. This is slide 12. So the x-axis is a scale factor. That's the lambda that we were just talking about. And the y-axis is the value of a 10J symbol. It's a log-log plot. And the dots, there's six different groups of dots, and each corresponding to starting with six different sets of 10 spins in the 10J symbol, and then scaling them by lambda. And then the lines show the predicted asymptotics, and you see that it matches perfectly. So this just verifies that we do really understand the asymptotics correctly. The lines there have slope minus 2. Okay, so that again will contrast with something I'll show in a few minutes. Okay, now I'm going to move on to another computation that involves the 10J symbol. This is slide 13 on the graviton propagator. So Rovelli and later others have talked about ways to define two-point functions in the Barrett-Crane model. I'm not going to go into detail about this, but the leading order contribution that they come up with is the formula shown there, WAB. It's got a sum which has some field insertions, HJA, HJB. So A and B are some fixed edges of a, you can think of them as edges of a 10J symbol, triangles of a four simplex. And there's a boundary state, capital Psi, which depends on the spins. The sum is over all labelings of the triangles of a four simplex by spins. So it's a tenfold summation. And then there's a 10J symbol with those 10 spins. And then the denominator is the same thing without the field insertions. So the field insertions are shown on the right-hand side. The next slide shows the same formula, slide 14, just made a bit more concise so I can also fit the boundary state on the slide. Okay, so we have our WAB, it's 1 over the normalization factor, then times the numerator with the field insertions. And then the boundary state that is proposed is a Gaussian, which is peaked around a regular four simplex. So you have a regular four simplex where you think of the triangles being labeled all by J sub 0, J naught, and then we sum over all labelings that may differ from that regular one, and with a Gaussian weighting. So there's, in the summation there, we sum over the differences, Ji minus J naught and Jk minus J naught. And then there's a 10 by 10 matrix alpha ik, which are some coefficients in the Gaussian. An important factor is the 1 over J naught in front of the sum. That's shown in green. That affects the width of the Gaussian. It makes it wider as J naught gets larger. And there's also a phase factor, I phi times the sum of the spins. Phi is the dihedral angle of the regular four simplex. Okay. So Rovelli did some calculations which argued that this scales correctly, which is that it goes as 1 over J naught for large J naught. That's what's expected to reproduce Newton's law. And I was interested in trying to verify those calculations. But trying to do it directly was impossible. The problem is that as J naught gets large, the Gaussian gets wider, and so you need to include more terms in the summation. And it's 10 nested summations, and so it just becomes impossible. Okay, so for quite some time, so in joint work with Simone Speziale, we tried to figure out a way to compute this to verify that it was really working correctly. So on slide 15, I'm showing something we came up with that does make it possible. So the simplification we make is to assume that this 10 by 10 matrix of coefficients, alpha ik, is actually just a scalar times the identity matrix, so alpha times delta ik. In that case, the boundary state, the Gaussian, simplifies. It becomes a product, so I'm looking at equation 10, a product of one factor for each k. And this lets us use a trick to simplify the calculation. So if you remember, the 10j symbol can be expressed as an integral over 5 copies of S3 of a product of 10 kernels, and there was one kernel for each k. Well, I was using different labels there, but there's one in this notation, there's one kernel for each k, just like this boundary state has one factor for each k. So if you leave that 10j symbol unintegrated, you don't use the algorithm that Greg Egan and I came up with to compute it directly. You think of it as an integral, and then you insert this boundary state in factored form, and then exchange the order of summation and integration, then what were 10 nested summations before become a product of 10 independent summations, and that's much easier to compute. The trade-off is that now you have a very high-dimensional integral to compute, and it's oscillatory, and we already know that the 10j symbol is almost impossible to compute that way, and now we're computing a big sum of 10j symbols effectively. So it turns out this is very difficult, but it's just at the brink of what we can compute using a large cluster of computers. Okay, so this is now on slide 16, shows the computations. So the x-axis is J naught, so that's the factor that determines the four simplex, the regular four simplex that things are centered upon. And the y-axis is WAB, the propagator. And we're hoping to see 1 over J naught behavior, and in fact we even have a predicted coefficient, and that red line shows the prediction, and the blue data shows the actual computations as J naught increases. And you see it goes exactly to the predicted asymptotics. So this is really good news. This is again a log-log plot, so that line is slope minus a half. This plot I think took about 1 year of CPU time to produce, so it was fairly difficult. But one thing we're quite excited about is the nice suppression for small J naught. You see this behavior that very closely mimics the 1 over J naught behavior, but rather than diverging at zero, you get this nice suppression that is showing the regularizing effect of the discreteness at the Planck scale. So I think this is a very nice feature of this plot. Now, unfortunately, other analytical work, has shown that there are problems with the graviton propagator if you look at its tensorial structure, if you look at other components of it. So again, there's despite this being a positive result, there is some negative work here, which shows that, again, the Barrett-Crane vertex may not be correct. So that leads into the next slide, which is going to discuss the new vertex proposals. Okay, so this is slide 17 we're on now. So in the past 6 months, there were three papers I want to highlight that proposed new vertex amplitudes. So the first one by Engel, Pereira, and Rovelli, it proposed a new vertex amplitude. And the idea was that rather than imposing the simplicity constraints strictly, they should be imposed weakly in the quantum theory. And the way this is expressed is that in the Barrett-Crane model, we didn't label anything with intertwiners. The intertwiners were all determined once the spin labels were determined. But in these models, the intertwiners have their own degrees of freedom. They're unfrozen. And that allows correlations between different force implices. So this is potentially a much more interesting model. In any case, they came up with a specific proposal for the vertex amplitude, which includes labelings of with intertwiners, as well as with spins. Then, shortly after that, Levine and Speziale also derived the same vertex from a different point of view, using coherent states, and they also proposed a specific edge amplitude. And then around the same time, I guess a little bit before that, according to the archive ordering, Friedel and Krasnov rederived that same amplitude, but also proposed an alternative amplitude that has even more degrees of freedom. So on the next slide, 18, I'm not going to give the details, but I just want to compare very briefly the data that you give in these models. So in the Barrett-Crane model, we labeled triangles with spin. That was the only data to give the spin foam. You just labeled the triangles with spin. So per dual vertex, that should say, so in other words, per four simplex, there are 10 spins, 10 J's that you have to label. In the first of the new models, in addition to those labels, you also have a label on each tetrahedron. And that means per four simplex, each four simplex has five tetrahedra in it. That means you have 10 spin labels and five intertwiner labels per four simplex. In the Friedel-Krasnov model, in addition to both the J's and the I's, there are some K labels, and there's one of those for each pair of a triangle and a tetrahedron containing that triangle. So that adds up to quite a few, because each triangle might be contained in more than one tetrahedron, and so it gets different labels for each one of those inclusions. So per four simplex, you end up with 10 spins, 5 I intertwiners, and 20 K intertwiners, so there's a lot more data. So the ultimate goal is to compare these models by computing something physical, like expectation values of observables. We haven't gotten there yet. But Igor has begun computations. This is again work of Igor Kavkin. And he wanted to begin by first comparing the vertex amplitudes. Now, more precisely, when I say vertex amplitudes, I mean to include some edge amplitude factors as well that vary between these models. But you can't compare them directly because they depend on different amounts of data. So his idea was to look at the, for fixed J's, look at the maximum contributions as you vary I and K, the I's and the K's. Find which I's and K's contribute the most for a particular set of J's, and look at the behavior of that contribution. And it's the graphs he has, which I haven't shown all of his data, but the graphs show that it's very peaked on certain I's and K's. So it doesn't appear that you're missing too much in the simplification. So then, but in order to do that, he needed to have algorithms for these new vertices. And this was quite a bit of work because they aren't just analogous to the 10J symbol. They're fairly different. And they're more complicated to compute. So he came up with an algorithm. The 10J algorithm takes J to the fifth time, if J is the average spin that you're computing with, and the new algorithms take J to the seventh. So they're a fair bit slower. Okay, so but nevertheless, there is code for computing them now, and so on slide 19, there are some results shown. So here he has taken all spins, all of the J's equal to a fixed J, and that's the x-axis. And as I said, the I's and the K's are chosen to maximize the contribution for those J's. This is a log-log plot, and the y-axis is the value of the vertex amplitude with the edge amplitudes that are necessary included in. The curve at the top, the red one, that's the Barrett-Crane vertex. So that curve is slope minus 2. It doesn't look that steep, but that's because the y scale is very extreme. As I said, it's log-log, but it's extremely log-log if you look at the exponents down the left column. So that's the Barrett-Crane vertex. The green one is the one that we label EPR, the Engel-Pereira-Rovelli model. And that one decays a fair bit faster. It's roughly as J to the minus 5.4. And then the Friedel-Krasnov model, there's two curves shown there. There's a dominant contribution in red and a subdominant contribution in blue. And they're roughly J to the minus 21 and J to the minus 20. So they show extremely different behavior. Again, this isn't a physically meaningful computation. It's just a first example of something that can now be computed now that the amplitudes can be computed. But it does show that they are very different, and there's no obvious oscillations occurring in them. These, again, may be hidden, or it may be that you need to take sums over the other labels. It's not clear exactly what one would expect to see here. But in any case, this is the beginning, and there's work in progress to do more computations of these models. Now, I also want to mention that several papers appeared on the archive yesterday that I haven't looked at, but there are some that also do different computations that I'm certainly excited to take a look at, but I haven't seen them, so I can't really comment on them.
Dan?
Yep.
So as you mentioned, this is not really a physical quantity, so therefore the disagreement of the curves doesn't mean anything, but isn't there something that one can quickly conclude that, you know, might imply differences for physics, or is just too difficult to do?
Well, yeah, I'm not sure. I think the differences will depend on the fine structure. So, for example, this is also only for all the J's equal. And so one would want to study things as the J's vary, and Igor has looked at that, but I'm just not presenting all of the data. So I think it's pretty hard to tell. And right now, it'll take a bit more work to get expectation values done, but it's certainly doable. And so that's something that's in progress.
Thanks.
Okay. So if there's no more questions about that, I'm going to switch gears.
Okay. Let me just ask quickly. Following up on Jorge's question, really. I mean, we had this very nice exchange of ideas between Marseille Group and Perimeter last time these models were discussed, the new models for vertex amplitudes.
Yep.
And there was this kind of debate about whether the Marseille model is more like a topological factor or not. Do these amplitudes say anything about this issue?
No, I don't think they do directly. Igor can correct me if I'm wrong. I think that'll have to wait for more detailed computation.
Okay.
Igor?
So, yeah, right now we can't say very much yet. I guess the test would be to compute some kind of complete partition function or some observables on close triangulation, not just a single four simplex, and to see if we get signatures of a topological model or not. But we can do that, but that's to come.
Okay. So, Igor, since you are on the line, I mean, how long did this plot take?
So this plot took, I'd say several hundred hours of CPU time. Yeah.
And so when Dan said that previously for the Barrett-Crane model, the time went as J to the fifth power, and now it's J to the seventh, that J to the fifth, Dan, was that the number that you get from the work that Egan and you have done?
That's right.
Okay.
And it seems like a small difference, but it's pretty big, actually.
Yeah, right. I mean, especially when J is increased. Yeah.
Any other questions? Okay. So I'll go on to slide 20. And this is where I'll talk about lattice gauge theory. So it's been known for a while that you can look at a dual form or dual formulation of lattice gauge theory. And several people, in particular the ones listed at the top of the page, have observed that spin foam methods can be used to understand this dual formulation. I want to emphasize I'm talking about an exact duality. There's also the strong coupling expansion, which is closely related, and I'll say a bit about that later. In this duality, in the usual form of lattice gauge theory, you express things as integrals where you put a group-valued variable on each edge. And in the dual form, those integrals are replaced with summations over representation variables that label the edges and the plaquettes, or the faces. So here we're working in a hypercubic lattice, so we usually call the faces plaquettes. So that sounds a lot like a spin foam. You've labeled edges and plaquettes with representation labels and are summing over them. And the terms in that summation turn out to involve spin network evaluations. Okay. So I'll say more about that on the next slide, but right now, I want to ask the question, well, why would you do this? What, you know, conventional lattice gauge theory has been around a long time and is well studied. Why look at the dual form? Well, conceptually, it is interesting. The configurations you're summing over each have a gauge invariant meaning. Because everything's expressed in terms of holonomies and you're representing things with the representations directly, it's a nice picture. And I'll show actually a figure in a couple of slides that illustrates this. It's possible that it'll be computationally faster in some context. That we haven't fully tested, but there have been other models in which by dualizing you get an improvement. So we're hoping that that'll be the case, at least in some situations. One important reason from our point of view is as a bridge to quantum gravity with Yang-Mills fields included. And the last point is that this may help with some of the hard problems in lattice gauge theory. For example, dynamical fermions, and that's something I'll also talk about briefly at the end. Okay, let me give a few details about how this dualization works. Excuse me for a second. Okay, so on slide 21, I'll briefly sketch the duality transformation. So equation 11 shows the traditional partition function. So as I said, it's an integral. There's one GE for each edge of the hypercubic lattice. And the integrand is a product of contributions coming from each plaquette. You take the exponential of minus the action, where G sub P is the product of the group elements labeling the edges of the plaquette, maybe with inverses thrown in. So that represents the holonomy around the plaquette. And then you take the action coming from that and multiply them together. So if you expand that exponential in terms of characters, so it turns out to be a class function, so you can expand it in terms of characters. So in 12, the sum over j's is, the j's are representations of the gauge group. And at this point, it could be any gauge group, any dimension, we're being generic. I'll specialize very soon, though. The c sub j's are just expansion coefficients, and the chi sub j's are the characters. So I've highlighted these parts in green. I'm going to substitute the character expansion in for the exponential. So that's shown in the last equation. and then in the last equality, I'm going to exchange. I'm going to move the summation past the product and then past the integration. So in some sense, this is actually the opposite of the transformation that was done to compute the graviton propagator. So here I'm starting with something that's a product of single index summations. But when I pass the summation outside of the product, now it becomes nested summations. And I also pass it out of the integral. Okay. So now it's a summation of over labeling of all the plaquettes by spins. So it's starting to look like a spin foam. All right. Okay, on the next slide, 22, I'll specialize to the case of D equals 3 and G being SU2. And in that case, you can work out these integrals in terms of spin networks. And this was known for some time, not exactly in this formulation, but it turns out to be equivalent. So what happens is you end up with a sum where you label all the plaquettes with spins, then another sum where you label all the edges with intertwiners between the four representations hitting it. And then you take a product of vertex contributions, a product of edge contributions, and a product of plaquette contributions. I have to keep taking a drink here. I'm starting to lose my voice. Okay, so as usual, the vertex amplitudes are the ones that are most interesting computationally. They're given by something that we call an 18J symbol. So it depends. So at a vertex in the lattice in three dimensions, there will be 12 plaquettes incident on it. So there's 12 J's, 12 representations. And there are 6 edges incident on it. So there's 6 intertwiners. So it depends on 18 pieces of data, which is why it's called an 18J symbol. So in the picture shown at the bottom of slide 22, there are 12 edges and 6 vertices. So the edges here get the spin labels, and the vertices get the intertwiner labels. There's also some normalization factors, the product of the N to the E's, and those are easy to compute. And then the plaquette factors are very easy to compute. There's some exponentials, those come from the character expansion coefficients. Okay, so I should also say that the labels in the summations that are occurring, the J sub P's and the I sub E's, are highly constrained. You get zero contributions unless you satisfy many different constraints. Okay, so before I go into more detail about the 18J symbol, I'll just show a picture of what this sort of summation looks like. Slide 23 shows an 8-cubed lattice. This is toroidal boundary condition, so each face is matched with its opposite face. And the shading, well, when there's no shading at all, that's a zero spin label on a plaquette. And then light gray is spin half, and as it gets more towards the blue, it's higher spin. The edge labels are not shown in the diagram. So that's the sort of states that are being summed over in this partition function. And this is drawn from a simulation that Wade Charrington did. Okay, so the next slide, 24, is probably very hard to read, and the details don't matter, so I apologize for the small font. I just want to say that there was some work involved in coming up with an algorithm for the 18J symbol. So you have to choose a basis for intertwiners so that you can label your intertwiners and sum over them. And one way to choose a basis for intertwiners that are four-valent vertex is to split it into two trivalent vertices connected by an edge. But there's three ways to do that splitting. And it turns out that the algorithm you end up with depends very highly on how you choose those splitting. And eventually, a splitting was found, which is shown here, which leads to a formula for the 18J symbol as a product of five tetrahedral networks and no summations. Simply a product of five tetrahedral networks when you do it the right way. And so four of them are shown in equation form at the bottom, and then there's one tet left over. And I won't go over all the details, but the idea is you do need to split the vertices in a very particular way, and it's not a regular way across the lattice. It forms a checkerboard pattern. But if you do that, you get a very fast algorithm for computing the 18J symbol. The tet networks can be computed in linear time. So this is a linear algorithm for the 18J symbol.
Excuse me, Dan? Just,
yes?
This is still the Wilson action, the E to the minus
sorry.
The Wilson action.
I'm sorry, I forgot to say that. No, we're using the heat kernel action.
Okay.
The heat kernel action is just simpler to work with in the dual. It's expected to produce the same physics, but you could use the Wilson action. You just get more complicated expansion coefficients. So the 18J symbol doesn't depend on the action. That's action independent. So the only thing that depends on the action is the plaquette factors. So at this point, it wouldn't matter, and you'd get just different coefficients in the character expansion.
Okay.
Okay, so now this formula that decomposes this into a product of five tets, this was known, and there had been attempts to try to use it to compute lattice gauge theory, but they weren't successful. And those past attempts, what they did is they treated the spin labels on the plaquettes as representing the state of a configuration. And then the intertwiner labels, they were summed over to get the amplitude. So this was difficult for two reasons. One is that those sums could be, they were nested summations, really, because they correlate with each other, so they could be very difficult to compute. But also, in that form, the amplitude is non-local. Excuse me. So in that form, the amplitude is non-local, which means if you make a local change, and if you're doing the Metropolis algorithm, you still need to recompute a large part of the amplitude, and that makes it slow as well. So the insight that Wade Charrington had, which is sort of obvious from the spin foam point of view, is to use both the plaquette labels and the edge labels as determining the state, and to move through both types of labels using Metropolis moves. This is a bit difficult to get right because it's highly constrained, and so it's difficult to come up with moves that satisfy the constraints. But this was done, and so combined with the algorithm for the 18J symbol, that leads to the possibility of doing computation. So slide 25 shows a plot. So this is, again, this is work of Wade Charrington. Igor and I contributed as well, but the Wade is really the lead in all this lattice gauge theory project. This plot, the x-axis is a coupling constant. The y-axis is the average spin. That's an observable that you can compute both on the conventional side and on the dual side. So you have to dualize that observable to compute it on the conventional side, but you can. The main part of the graph actually shows two curves. They're right on top of each other, so you can't see the difference. One of them is the computation done with the conventional method, and one is done using the dual method. Because they're so close, there's an inset plot which shows the relative error. So that's the difference between the two divided by the conventional value. And you see it's always within 1%, and it's always within 3 sigma of being 0. So this is done mainly as a check to make sure we're doing things correctly, because there was a lot of different work coming together in order to do these computations, and it would be very easy to have a sign mistake or some other conceptual error. And so this was a verification that showed that we're getting exact agreement with the conventional way of doing the computation.
John, can I ask a question?
Yes.
So the conventional and dual features, as gamma grows, is the error increasing in a similar way? Because from the blow-up picture, is one of the two more responsible for the increasing error, or they're both increasing in the same way?
Let me try to remember that. So there's one direction where the dual method is not working as well. And I can't remember if it's the large gamma or the small gamma off the top of my head. There's one direction where there's a slight problem with the dual method that we're still working on. So I'm sorry I can't answer that off the top of my head, and Wade can't be here right now. To answer it. Now, it says at the bottom, this is an 8-cubed lattice. That's a very small lattice. Wade's also done 16-cubed, and the results are very similar. The error bars are just a little bit bigger. He's also done some computations involving exact partition function calculations and got an agreement there. So as I said, this is really just a test. This is just to show that, in principle, this method can work, because in the past, it had been thought it didn't work. The computations had done and hadn't worked. And so now we want to show that with the new way of approaching it, it does work. And so now the stage is set for doing some real computation. Okay, slide 26, it discusses Wade's current and future work. So of course, one important goal is to move to dimension 4. This will actually be quite straightforward. The 18J symbol becomes a 32J symbol, so there's some more complicated spin network evaluations that need to be done. But conceptually, there's nothing really different. It's just a matter of of putting it all together and doing the computation. So that's work in progress. Passing to a higher gauge group is also, of course, important. So SU3 would be a prime example. And that will be a little bit more work, because the representation theory and the spin network evaluations for SU3 are not as well studied. So that'll require some new software for doing the evaluations. But again, that's work in progress. These next two, Wilson loops and dynamical fermions, maybe I should have listed them first, because they are further in progress. So Wade has started doing computations of more interesting observables, in particular Wilson loops, rather than just the average spin. And I will show a picture just illustrating things from simulations on the next slide. So that was a straightforward change. Moving to dynamical fermions is a much more subtle change. So Wade has figured out the theoretical background for doing that, and that's in a paper that's just been accepted in Nuclear Physics B, and that now lays the groundwork for doing the computation. And I'll show a picture of that, but I won't go into a lot of detail about it. Finally, for future work is coupling to quantum gravity. So now both lattice gauge theory and spin foams are phrased in terms of summations over spin foams of certain amplitudes with vertex edge and phase contribution. And so it's just completely straightforward to add both actions into the, multiply them together and look at what you get. So this is, again, work that hasn't begun. This is all very recent, just knowing that this is even possible. But there's a whole array of things that can now be done now that you can translate the conventional formulation to this dual formulation. Okay, I'm already over time, so I'm going to quickly look at some pictures. So slide 27, this is the Wilson loop page. So on the left, you'll see a single kind of reddish square loop. It's a bit hard to see maybe, but there's a little loop there that's some flux that's introduced. And then you can see how a square has to fill in to match those boundary conditions. And that is supposed to illustrate confinement. So this is an actual image taken from a simulation. And you can also compute two-point correlation functions by having two loops separated by a distance. Okay, so he's already doing work that does the Wilson loop observables. For the dynamical fermions, page 28, here the fermions, they have a polynomer representation on the edges. So there's two images. One is dimension 2 on the left, and there he's done the image for G being U1. And what happens is the fermions, the polymers have to be self-avoiding. And so you get these loops. You also get some dimers and monomers. And that's the only things that can occur. When you pass to three dimensions, you still live on the edges. And in the image on the right, the gauge groups also change to SU2, which means you're allowed to have some self-intersections in a certain constrained way. So these are images illustrating how the simulation should go, but this is the theoretical background, as I said, has been accepted in a paper, but the computational work is still to be done. Okay, so I'll just move on. I just want to conclude one last slide, slide 29. So I've tried to illustrate that using computation has every time led to new and usually unexpected insights. So I think it's really true. Every time I've tried to compute something, I've been surprised by the answer. I think that's good. I think that that it's interesting to see things from a different point of view. And in many cases, those surprises were then verified after the fact. Once you know what to look for, it's often you can often verify analytically that that's really the case. Also, computations can help choose between existing models or suggest new models. And we've seen that. And in the last section, I illustrated how computational techniques that were developed in one area, the spin network library in particular, turned out to be quite useful in another area, so in lattice gauge theory in this case. Okay, so I'll just end by reading this cartoon, Calvin and Hobbes. So Calvin says, if I had a computer, I'm sure I'd get better grades in my book reports. And his dad says, well, you'd still have to read the book and tell the computer what you want to say, you know. And Calvin says, man, what's all this fuss about computers? Well, it's true, you do have to tell the computer what to do, and it can be a lot of work, but I think it's worth it and can be quite rewarding. Okay, so thank you very much. Questions?
Okay, I have a couple of questions. I mean, on slide 10, you mentioned the Barrett-Crane model and how Barrett and Williams had studied this integral. And then you said there was a happy news that it has to do that reaction.
Mm-hmm.
But then we also know that they actually did not take into account these degenerate configurations that you referred to later on.
Yep.
So then it is correct to say that, in fact, if one did the correct calculation, then one does not get the reaction?
Well, what you get is a sum of contributions. And what I'm saying isn't necessarily at the level of a theorem, but there's a degenerate contribution that we understand well. There's a regiaction contribution. There may be others. I can't rule that out. But the graviton propagator computations, and I didn't mention this, but I probably should have, The heuristic argument that was used to get the 1 over J naught behavior analytically was that the degenerate contributions should disappear because of the phase that appears in that Gaussian state, and that should leave the regiaction there to give the correct asymptotics. So in some sense, the fact that the graviton computations really do produce the 1 over J naught are a verification that the Reggie action is hidden in there and doing its job, even though it's masked by the degenerate contributions. I'm not 100% sure that the story is that simple, but I think it's definitely good news that you can still get the right behavior in a real computation, even though the vertex amplitude alone doesn't show a behavior you might have expected.
But I think if I just looked at the vertex amplitude now, the improved ones, do I see something there which is familiar, like I should get the right answer, like along the lines of Barrett and Williams? Has anybody done?
Yeah, I'm not sure if anyone has done the stationary phase computation, but I guess the point is that you can't tell just by looking at the vertex amplitude. It's not enough data to just do a single plot and say, oh, that looks right or not. And you have to do something more physical. You know, that will be done.
So when we tell to outside people, I guess we should not emphasize so much about Reggie action coming out, but we should emphasize this graviton propagator result. Because, as you said, there are many contributions coming out, and some of them have to be washed out by the semi-classicality of the state.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Your comment on Abai's question. I mean, the asymptotic is hard to get for these models, but also these new models we expect to see, and maybe, you know, and this has to be done numerically, is whether there is going to be correlation. So essentially the question is, suppose you put a non-zero volume intertwiner on the boundary of the four simplex. You want to see whether these things propagate, you know, consistently. Or, you know, because in the Barrett crane somehow it always go back to the zero volume state. So that's the hope with these things, and it should be checked.
So if I can say
numerically. And it seems that there's some recent work just done yesterday that start to show that this is indeed the case for very simple things.
Yeah, but this is Igor from Wisdom. So if I can just say something about that. I haven't looked in detail at the new papers yet, but just from my own calculations, just preliminarily I can say that there is some propagation of these correlations, but right now it's numerically it's hard to disentangle it from some numerical noise, just because the region where you do the computations, the amplitude is extremely tiny compared to, I guess, what you'd call the more degenerate contribution.
Okay. Igor, since you're on the line, let me just ask. So in these calculations, I don't know if you are involved or Cherrington. I guess maybe it's Cherrington who is more involved. With these calculations of the Wilson loop observables.
Right.
What about just using U1 theory? That is U1. And seeing, I mean, there the calculations must be much easier. Is that right?
Well, in my understanding, and I'm not an expert on this, the U1 calculations have been done. And there the dual model has proved, in fact, more efficient than some regimes than the usual computation.
And this is in the papers already, or this
it's already out in the literature. I mean, I think people like Polakoff were involved with developing the dual model in the first place, and then some people later on took that up in computational scheme.
Oh, so it's in the older literature,
Okay.
Well, there's even proof of confinement for you know, coupling. Using these dual formulas.
I wanted to know if, in fact, these particular algorithms that you are using are more efficient than the standard ones.
The efficiency is unknown yet. So far, we've checked correctness, and the dual computations did not seem significantly slower than the regular algorithms. But it's a question also of optimization and also reaching the correct regime.
This is in 3D?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Do you have any hope that the dynamical fermions will be more efficient? Because that's been the big sticking problem for conventional lattice gauge theory.
Okay. So Wade has some ideas, and so his paper about that is already on the archive and has been accepted to Nucleus Physics B. I can't say much about it, but at least it's possible to do it. I don't know about the efficiency.
Yeah, I think at this point it's another few weeks or a month or something before he'll have actual data. But the groundwork is laid for doing it, and now we simply have to try it. A lot of these things you can't tell ahead of time how efficient they'll be.
I just wonder, I mean, most of you may know it already, but not everybody maybe. In the last 18 months or so, lattice gauge theory, there has been enormous progress, right? I mean, and that occurred in part because they could use they could combine the lattice gauge theory techniques with some things from perturbation theory. And the two together have improved, and in fact, people are making now very realistic calculations. And the error bars are now reduced to 1 or 2% as opposed to 10%. And so that is something that one should also perhaps look out for as to what we can borrow from known perturbative results, which is kind of outside our normal domain, but this is where the progress is occurring.
That's very interesting.
Further questions? Okay, if there are no more questions, let's thank Dan again.
Thank you very much.